Welcome, everyone, to Monday Match Analysis. I'm Gil Gross. Casper Ruud is an ATP 500 champion in Barcelona. He beat Stefanos Tsitsipas in the final in straight sets, a rematch of the Monte Carlo final last week. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Jan Lennart Struff beating Taylor Fritz, winning Munich, his first career title. We will hit on Rafael Nadal, who made his return to tennis, first time since January of this year. And ultimately, he lost to Alex de Minaur, second round. We'll have some thoughts there. And to cap it off, I know people will be excited for this, the first rendition of the 2024 French Open power rankings. We start with Barcelona. It's going to have a different tune than last week because I saw it as a very different match than last week. It was an interesting one, the Monte Carlo final. I was a little bit negative. I knew how some people were going to react to that. I actually told my girlfriend after the show, I said, yeah, some people won't like this one. I knew it because when you're negative, it's never the popular choice. Like, it's never going to be the way to gain universal appeal because neither fan base ends up really embracing it. Obviously, for Casper Ruud, who I didn't feel performed well in the Monte Carlo final, speaks for itself. But even if you're a massive Stefanos Tsitsipas fan, you'd much rather hear me say that Ruud played awesome, but Tsitsipas was unreal. He was way too good. 10 out of 10, right? It's just a nicer thing to hear. So I get all that. But obviously, I'm going to continue to watch matches as carefully as possible and make good faith assessments of what I see. Again, all that to say that I couldn't feel more differently about this Barcelona final, which to me was one of the best matches I've seen Ruud play. It was up there. And I think Tsitsipas was at least somewhere in the range of his average level. I'm not going to say it was spectacular, and I'm not going to say it was some epic match that, you know, will go down as one of the best of the year. But Tsitsipas by no means did himself, sold himself short with the performance and the effort. But to me, the storyline is Casper in a big final, not a big final, but a final above 250 level for the first time, clearing the bar of an elite player. Clearing the bar because Tsitsipas didn't hand it over. And I'll get into what impressed me so much about the performance. First off, he served 80% and the forehand was a big bad weapon, rarely misfired after the first couple games. I mean, that's Casper Ruud's strengths. And your strengths need to be strong. It was. So check. But what made this performance, what pushed it over the edge, what made it that extra bit impressive was the stuff that he did well that he usually doesn't do all that well, or at least stuff that he doesn't even attempt to do all that often because it's outside of his comfort zone. Backhands down the line, mixing up return positions, backhand passing shots, all of these things that I just mentioned were actually a really big part of Casper Ruud's success in this final. There were lessons learned from Monte Carlo, a lot of them. I want to start with his mindset from the baseline, which I thought was the most interesting adjustment that Casper made against Tsitsipas to turn the tides here. You know, in Monte Carlo, there was a lot of working the point to Tsitsipas' backhand side, really favoring that wing, trying to make Stefanos hit one-handers, waiting for some sort of invitation to attack, which often never came. It was a more predictable approach, a more passive approach. Steph did not have that mindset at all, or those tactics. He said, well, forget hitting it to Casper's backhand over and over again. If he gives me some open court, I'm going to crush the ball into that open, into that space. So the forehand inside in, the backhand down the line from Tsitsipas, and even on some occasions, the forehand cross court from the middle of the court, that was very much a part of Tsitsipas' regular diet of ground strokes because the way Casper Ruud moves around a tennis court, that's the side where often you have more space to hit into. Same thing for Tsitsipas. The way Tsitsipas moves is the same. There is a heavy bias to the left, a heavy bias to the backhand corner, and Rude was ready to take advantage of that this time. Taking the ball big into Tsitsipas's forehand as soon as possible. Attacking there at the first opportunity. And the result was, well, you know, you go from Casper Ruud's perspective, you go from passing up opportunities to put Tsitsipas in trouble by perhaps taking a ball that you could attack with the forehand inside in, and instead you trade with the forehand inside out, just as an example, just to make Tsitsipas hit another backhand. So you go from that to, no, this is my ball where I can do damage on it right here, right now. And instead of hitting that forehand inside out, you see Rude hitting a big forehand inside in and taking control, because oftentimes Tsitsipas isn't leaning that direction. So I thought Casper, by going to that Tsitsipas forehand, was inherently more aggressive, because when you target that side, you have to be forceful when you're hitting it there. Like, you just have to, and you know that in your bones. So I thought that kind of forced Casper to inject pace and to kind of bring an aggressive mindset to the way he was producing his ground strokes. But also, you see the power of anticipation when it comes to movement around a tennis court. You really saw that. Because in Monte Carlo, it would feel like at times that Tsitsipas was all over the court, and that, you know, he was continuously on balance, and that he knew where Ruud was going to go with the ball. And, you know, he got early jumps into the corners every time. And it felt the opposite this time. It seemed like Ruud oftentimes, when he was attacking, got sort of a wrong footing effect, that Tsitsipas would maybe, you know, lean left and then suddenly he'd have to go right. Or he would, you know, eventually later on in the match, he would lean right and then wait, no, he has to go left. That split second of kind of wrong-footedness or off-balance out of the split step when you're looking to accelerate into one of the corners, it makes all the difference. And you only get that reward, you only earn that wrong-footing effect by being unpredictable. And by taking, I'm going to use, you know, I talked to Hugh Clark, obviously last week in the mailbag. And one of the things when we talked about Ruud is he said the backhand down the line could be so crucial for him, because in order to really maximize your game from the baseline, you have to be able to hit to every location from each wing. And when you're missing, let's say your backhand down the line and you're going cross 85% of the time, or something like that. Like, you just, or you're going inside out on your forehand 70% of the time. You're losing that opportunity of unpredictability, and you're going to make your opponent's movement look better than it really is, because they're reading your patterns. And then even in trading, like even in neutral, when you take away Tsitsipas's ability to kind of move early to his left, you could hit some balls towards his backhand that in Monte Carlo he might have been able to take as a forehand because he was going left early. But in Barcelona, after Ruud ripped a bunch of forehand inside in, and, you know, forehands cross from the middle and backhands down the line, Steph has to stay honest. And now he's a second late going left, and he has to hit a backhand. So it makes a huge difference. And at the end of the day, all this is a, you know, a more detailed, nuanced, complex way to say Ruud found ways to be more aggressive and more offensive. And, you know, we've seen it time and time again. He doesn't beat top players when he has to defend a lot. He just doesn't. And that's why he hadn't been able to get over the hump in these big finals, is he's going up against great players and his forehand wasn't coming to play. And the backhand directionals were predictable, and there was too much working the point and not enough taking opportunities to take control. That's what he rectified in this final, to me, more than anything. I want to give some examples of this, of Ruud attacking into Tsitsipas's forehand side. 5 all in the first set. And I hope this is helpful. I don't have screenshots this week, but I hope it is helpful to just kind of go through these big points. And I just like to prove my work, right? And kind of just hammer home the point with direct examples of what happened in this match. So 5 all, 30 all. Rud hits a nice backhand cross-court trade, really deep. And Tsitsipas kind of has to take a backhand on the rise because of the depth that Rud found. So now Casper knows Steph isn't going to go on the rise down the line. You know it's cross-court. What does Rud do? Anticipate. So he moves early left, has a runaround forehand, inside in right away. The first time. Not messing around with the inside out. Inside in build, forehand cross-court angle finish. Brilliant combo on the forehand. Two fantastic forehands. That made it 40-30. High-quality rally there. Tsitsipas hit a backhand cross-court trade. Rud hit a backhand down the line winner. And it was not a bad cross-court by Tsitsipas. The depth was fine. It was actually solid depth. It wasn't too slow. It wasn't mishit. Nothing was wrong with it. In that moment, Rud backed himself going for the tougher shot to redirect with the backhand down the line, not on an obvious opportunity to do so, really just on a neutral ball. And Tsitsipas was completely caught off guard, wasn't covering it at all, because it was the same thought process that Rud had on the previous point. Tsitsipas hit a decent backhand cross court. He assumed the ball was going to come back cross court. And Rud said, I'm on the run. You hit pretty good depth, but you know what? Let's roll the dice here. Let's trust my backhand and my two-hander down the line. And Steph could barely move for it. I wanted to talk about those 2 points. That was 5-all, first set, 30-all. So Tsitsipas was really knocking on the door there. Pressure point. In the next game, Rud would break. It gets me to my next sort of key, which is Casper's passing shots on the backhand side. We've covered a couple times. Twice, to be specific, matches in which Rud couldn't figure out a way to pass on the backhand and opponents took advantage. There was the Norrie match at the Australian Open. There was the Jordan Thompson match in the final of Los Cabos. You know, Norrie not known as a net rusher. Jordan Thompson, yes, is known as a net rusher. And both of them were able to really execute that tactic. And Rud just kind of was left wanting on his ability to pass on the backhand. Yeah, he got it done. He got it done this time. At 15-all in this 5-6 service game, Tsitsipas serving, Rud hit the hardest open stance backhand I've ever seen him hit. It was down the line for a winner. At 15-30, Rud had moved back, and Tsitsipas decided, let's go to the serve and volley that worked so well in Monte Carlo. So kick wide, serve and volley. Rud was deep, but he cranked the backhand return down the line, got it low, got it close to the sideline. Tsitsipas, super difficult volley, popped it up, set up an easy pass on the next ball. Great return. Great return. Off of a backhand from deep and wide in the court, you know, out of position, an out of position backhand. Next point, 15-40, Tsitsipas delayed approach on a forehand inside out. He saw Rud was slicing on the run. He saw that the slice was coming. But the slice, it stayed low. It went down the line, which was the furthest distance that Tsitsipas could travel because, remember, he was coming from his backhand side. So he had to go diagonally, and he couldn't quite close in on the net fast enough. It turned into a really low volley from about, you know, shin level, and Tsitsipas put it in the net. Really tough volley. This was the only questionable approach. It was a somewhat questionable decision just because Tsitsipas was pretty far back to hit an approach shot. He had both feet behind the baseline by maybe a couple of feet. That said, it's always a high percentage play to come in off of someone who's slicing. And he did that. So I don't have any major qualms or criticisms of anything that Tsitsipas did here. Rud really earned this with 3 good backhand passing shots. The other point in the game, by the way, was a backhand unforced error by Tsitsipas that missed by like maybe a couple of centimeters long on the baseline. So you could hardly fault Steph for that unforced error just because You know, I'm never going to be overly critical of a player who makes an unforced error a couple of centimeters long of the baseline. You know, there was no bad decision. It happens. So Rude really earned this break, and it won him the first set 7-5. Quickly, I just want to continue to point out that in the second set, the break came at 2-1, and it also came from the, you know, really the same stuff. Rude offensive excellence. He had a backhand down the line to break open the point at Love All, finishes with an aggressive forehand cross. Love 15, he hit a forehand inside in for a winner. That is was another prime example of Tsitsipas he just wasn't covering it. Like he's thinking that the inside out is coming, and Rude hits the inside in. Love 30, Love 40, couple of forehand unforced errors by Steph, and Rude broke at Love. But notice like how many of these points I'm talking about, Casper is winning on his own terms, like with his own excellence. And that's why I feel so strongly that he fully earned it, and that it was one of the best performances that I've seen from him. Also made a correction on the second serve returning, which was really my main sticking point of the Monte Carlo final performance. He started the match standing in. It had some mixed results in terms of the quality of return that he was able to produce, but ultimately it made Tsitsipas scrap the tactic, the serve and volley, that worked so well for Steph in Monte Carlo. He had to throw that out the window because he saw Rude standing in. Even when Rude stood back, I think just the knowledge that Casper was willing to make the adjustment and move in kind of got Tsitsipas off of the serve and volley tactic. Now, maybe it would have been interesting if he was a little bit more stubborn about saying, okay, if you move back, I'm going to serve and volley. If you move up, I won't. And just really playing that game more stubbornly than he did, instead of being like, okay, so, you know, you've shown me the counter, I'll just kind of throw away the serve and volley or save it for a big point, which I think is what he really ended up trying to do. But ultimately, serve and volley wasn't an issue for Rude. And overall, the return quality was way better. I don't know if I have like any hard, fast opinion or super strong opinion about how Rude improved his return, but I do wonder if deep middle was more of a focus, because I did notice that at the end of the day, it wasn't like he was guiding the ball into Tsitsipas's backhand and making him hit first ball backhands. It was mostly just a matter of the depth and the quality, usually through the middle of the court. But that's more important, ultimately. It's more important that you hit the ball deep and that you get some pace on it, ideally, or some weight of shot on it, than you direct it towards Tsitsipas's backhand. Because if you direct your return to Tsitsipas's backhand and it's short and it's slow, guess what? He ain't hitting the backhand. He's not. He is way too quick running around. So I feel like that might have been an adjustment by Casper, but I'm not 100% sure. All right, as for Tsitsipas's performance, obviously I said at the top that I thought it was, you know, in the range of his averages, but my criticisms would be this. Forehand got wild in the second set. It went off on him a little bit. First serve percentage was low again, 57%. Wasn't as bad as it was in Monte Carlo, but it, you know, 57 is still somewhat low. His average this year, however, is 57.8%. That is by far the worst of his career. So first serve percentage, and I know that there was the back injury. I know there was the experimentation with the pinpoint stance that I'm really happy he's gone away from. I thought that was a somewhat senseless experiment. But anyway, his percentage of first serves in over the course of this year is by far the worst in his career. And that was an issue again. I also thought that he took some return games off. There were some return, it didn't really happen for him on serve, but there were some return games, including the third game of the match when Rude, because Tsitsipas broke initially, Rude played a sloppy game right away, but, or maybe it was the 3-love game where Rude held, where I just saw like kind of a sudden dip in effort, focus, and decision-making. So he was a little bit in and out, right? And that's not ideal. You want to be engaged, obviously, and threatening every single return game. I didn't see that from Tsitsipas. And Steph mentioned after the match that he didn't feel like he had the mental capacity to fully fight in this match. And this is where I'll bring in the fatigue thing. I'm sure there will be comments about this. Hopefully those who comment will have made it to this part of the analysis. But yeah, certainly that's a factor in this match, because it's not an insignificant task at all for Tsitsipas. Coming off a title, back-to-back three-set matches heading into this final. But of course, Ruud traversed the same ground, Monte Carlo final, Barcelona final. The difference is he won every match in Barcelona in straights. And you can't really say it's because of the draw. Ruud actually played higher ranked opponents than Tsitsipas. So that just comes down to, you know, credit to Casper. He did a great job of taking care of his business this week, a little bit easier than Tsitsipas. That's all I got on Barcelona. Let's go to Munich. Jan-Lennard Struff wins his first title. Hard not to smile, because it's really easy to be thrilled for Struff. He'd been close before. I mean, Stuttgart last year was agonizing. He had a championship point. He didn't get broken the whole match, and he lost in a third set tiebreak to Tiafo. And then right after that, and remember, he had made the Madrid final earlier, his first big final. He had a really bad hip injury and extremely untimely. Extremely untimely. So, you know, 33-year-old, you know, was playing the best tennis of his life, has this a hip injury, and, you know, it wasn't easy sledding coming back. Clock was winding down. He's 34 years old. You're just hoping that it's going to work out for him, you know, one of these weeks. And it did. Third oldest player to win his first career title. Paolo Lorenzi was 34 and when he won Kitzbühel in 2016, and Victor Estrella Burgos or Burgos was 34 as well when he won Quito in 2015. So Struff is third now on that list. And he did it at home. He did it in Munich, beating Taylor Fritz, straight sets. Observations from the match. First off, they're playing on a clay court. It is raining, and it is freezing cold. I think it might have been below freezing. I mean, talk about the perfect storm to create slow conditions. Pretty crazy stuff. Struff is one of maybe the few guys on tour. I mean, the list is not long. Of players who, no matter how slow and heavy the conditions are, they are never going to have trouble creating some offense, right? Like, if he's taking that much time away, hitting the ball that hard, doing it off of both wings, coming forward, it is a maximized, optimized cocktail of aggression that Struff brings to a tennis court. And that's why, like, it doesn't matter if it's freezing cold and raining on a clay court, like, Struff is still going to be able to make some things happen, which is pretty awesome. He was more deadly than Fritz on his forehand. He was destroying Fritz's second serve. Fritz just couldn't protect it. And I feel like Jan-Lennard, I've said this before, probably the best in the world at seeing second serves and thinking, yup, I am going to blitz this ball. Now, he does a pretty good job of keeping it in play as well, because he's not usually playing close to the lines. It's just one of those things where he's standing close, he's belting it, and you just gotta, like, it's so hard to defend when you're recovering out of your service motion. And Struff just, he takes advantage of that better than anybody. And obviously, because the serve is such a controlled shot, right? Like, any pro who wants to hit tee and wide can hit tee and wide. In order for Struff's thing to work, he has to be able to do it off of both wings. And he can. which is so essential. So there's no reprieve. It doesn't matter which side you serve to. You really, in my opinion, you have to serve him big to the body or slice to his forehand, which is kind of tough on clay. But if you're not doing either of those things, you're just at his mercy. And I think it's potentially worth risking double faults. It might be worth risking some double faults because you could get some cheap points with him, you know, standing in and being aggressive with his second serve return position. I never felt like Fritz actually like adjusted the sliders on his second serve. Like at no point was Taylor like, I'm just not winning second serve points. And I believe at the end of the match, he was around 33% win rate on second serves. At no point was he like, let's just go bigger. Like, forget it. Like, if I double fault, I double fault, but I got to try something here. Taylor just never got to that point. I think that would be my main criticism for Fritz's performance. But ultimately, I think that Struff played incredibly well, and making Taylor defend, which is what Struff does best, big serves, big returns, first strike tennis, making Taylor defend is the best way to play him. It's attacking his weakness. He is a terrific attacking player. He's tremendous with time. He is tremendous when he sets his feet and he gets to hit ground strokes from stationary positions. He is incredibly consistent from neutral. He maintains depth really well from neutral. He just doesn't defend all that athletically or explosively. He can make some extra balls, especially on clay. He works hard. He hustles. He gets extra balls in play, but he's just not going to hit you with the agility and the balance and the shot-making ability to really like turn defense to offense on a regular basis. And obviously you can get the ball by him. He's not the quickest in the world. So I think Struff is uniquely suited to take advantage of that, to make Fritz defend a lot. So again, lastly, I mean, Jan Lennard in full force, he's a joy to watch. He's one of these players who's pretty much just incomparable on tour. Like, he's one of these guys who I don't know anyone else who plays exactly like him. And those guys just tend to make this sport better. And by all accounts, he's a great guy. And this was an awesome story. So really good stuff in Munich. I want to talk about Nadal. Barcelona, second round exit at the hands of Alex de Moore, did get a win over Flavio Cabali in the first round. Wonderful to see him out there again. He got another win. He hung with de Moore for 10 games, and he had tons of opportunities to take that opening set. A couple of second serve returns that he didn't make in play that maybe could have swung the first set his way. A break point that de Moore played really well towards the tail end of that first set that would have saw Nadal serve for it at 5-3. So there were chances. Like, he was right there with an Alex de Moore who's been really awesome this year and in form. So it's kind of a continuation of the idea that, like, Rafa, when he's played this year, when he's been able to make it out onto court, there's a lot to like. I mean, every time he's played this year, his ball striking has been S tier. The forehand has looked like, you know, an all-time great forehand. But there are also two major issues that I think are pretty glaring right now. Physicality and serve. Those are the two. Physicality is something that de Moore took the court looking to extract, and he did so really well. He's extremely well suited stylistically to be able to do that. And he played it perfectly. He stayed very disciplined. He used his wheels to make extra balls. He looked to make every return point physical. And Nadal did seem to get tired feet eventually. His level dipped. End of the first, start of the second, where the feet got tired. He made some errors that came down to positioning. He ultimately slowed down when he had to defend. Flavio Cabali did not do this, right? He missed too much to make it physical. Alex de Moore was going to make no such error. Nadal is 3-0 this year in matches that finish in under an hour and a half. He is 0-2 in matches that finish after the 130 mark. And then the second thing is the serve. Now, he hasn't been serving due to injuries. The serve has been the troublesome aspect of his game from a health standpoint, at least over the course of the last month or so. There's been abdominal stuff. I don't know if there's been other stuff. Rafa has been increasingly, you know, less and less forthcoming with the specifics of what's bothering him. But we do know that in his training, he hadn't been serving. And it shows, right? It's slow. It's basically always a body serve or a slice to the righty backhand. So you can kind of sit on that. Demon Orr maybe could have done an even better job of sitting on that. And of course, one and two, physicality serve, they go together. They're married to each other. Because the worse you serve, the more physical it gets. That said, if the goal is to play Roland Garros at a respectable level, and right now, I believe that is the goal, there is nothing more than that, there is nothing less than that, then this was a really positive week. He got on court and got off court healthy, and that's really all you could have asked for. All right, it is time for the Roland Garros Power Rankings. I'll show you a quick look at the 2023 Power Rankings. This was how it ended last year. And in parentheses, I've also put the result, the ultimate result of Roland Garros. So all four semifinalists were inside the top 10 of the Power Rankings. You know, you had Medvedev losing in the first round. You had Sinner losing in the second round. Rublev in the third round. Fritz in the third round. Those were kind of the players who got upset within the Power Rankings. But yeah, I don't know. I wanted to flash that up on the screen, but I don't have much more to say about it. Without further ado, the first edition. Oh, actually, no. I need to do my preamble shtick first, because the Power Rankings are not a concept that is easily grasped by all on first try. And it has been a while. So quick refresher. I do the Power Rankings as a way of tracking form and results throughout the lead up of a slam. And the fun part about it is seeing the movement of the players, not necessarily, you know, doing it for the first time. It's just a starting point. But I think the most important thing that I like to make a distinction between is the Power Rankings are actually not my prediction. They are not predictive. So it's not my opinion right now of what is going to happen at Roland Garros. Instead, it's my most fair, objective ranking of how, based on the evidence and the past performance, essentially based on what we've seen, how the players should, you know, be stacking up in terms of chances to win the French Open. Okay? Does that make sense? So I really do try to be objective and take my own personal inklings and opinions out of it. All right? No, obviously there is it's not a fully objective exercise, because I have to decide, well, what's more important? So-and-so has been awesome this season, but player B was great on clay courts last year. So what do I think is more relevant? That's where I come in. But other than that, I try to leave myself out of it. All right, 3-2-1 reveal. French Open Power Rankings. I'll read them off, and I'll keep my explanation short. But I have Djokovic at 1, Sinner at 2, Alcaraz at 3, Tsitsipas at 4, Rude at 5, Zverev at 6, Medvedev at 7, Rune at 8, Dimitrov at 9, Rublev at 10. And then my next out category, the players who I considered putting in this top 10 but didn't quite make it, are Alex de Minaur, Hubert Hurkacz, and Karen Khachanov and Matteo Berrettini. All right. So quickly, let's run through this. Again, I'm not going to get into too much detail, but as we move forward throughout the clay court season, I am going to elaborate on this more and more and more until usually at the end, I make like a 30, 40-minute video just on the power rankings before the French starts. All right. Number one, Djokovic. Body of work throughout his illustrious career. Plus, if you look at what he did in Monte Carlo, I don't know how you can't take that as a positive. Literally his best Monte Carlo result in years. Regarding him pulling out of Madrid, no concern whatsoever. I just think he's made a decision that Madrid, in general, actually doesn't help his Roland Garros prep. I wouldn't be stunned if he never plays that event ever again. At number two, I have Sinner. Why number two? Well, he's got no big titles on clay, no Roland Garros quarterfinals to his name, but he's been the best player in the world so far this year. Alcaraz is at three. He has started the clay season with two withdrawals due to forearm injury. Look, it's tough between like Djokovic, Sinner, Alcaraz. I mean, that's a tough trio to kind of parse, but it does make life pretty easy on me when you're starting off the clay season in the worst possible way, which objectively speaking, Alcaraz is from a health standpoint. Tsitsipas is at four. Winner of the first clay court Masters, former Roland Garros finalist, Roland Garros semifinalist as well. I feel pretty comfortable with him at four. Didn't have to think too hard about that. At five, I have Ruud. He is the ATP wins leader this year. He is the reigning Roland Garros finalist. And he no longer has the mental baggage of having never won a title above 250 level. At five, I have Zverev. Sasha has made three consecutive Roland Garros semifinals, but so far he's having a very tier two season. Not a lot of big splashes, not a lot of big wins against top guys, other than, of course, the Alcaraz win at the Australian Open, which at this point feels kind of like a long time ago. Medvedev is next. He is one of the four best players in the world right now, but that ranking is kind of deducted due to clay. Not too heavily. He is weakened, but still capable. I'll leave it at that. Holger Rune comes in at number eight. Had one of the best clay court seasons of anyone last year, but he's 12th in the race, and he's yet to make a splash in his two clay court events this year. So, you know, it's just been a while for Holger since I've seen him really put together a great start-to-finish week. It's been a while, and that's why he's a little bit lower than maybe I would have predicted he'd be if you were to ask me after the French Open last year where Holger would end up in the RG Power Rankings in 2024. I probably would have predicted like five at the lowest, but that's not how things have played out. At number nine, I have Grigor Dimitrov. This is basically based, you know, the reason he's here is because his results have been so good over the last year, but he's never made a French Open quarterfinal. So it's kind of a question mark in that respect. And then at number 10 is Andrei Rublev, who's lost four straight matches, but he hangs on to the top 10 based on years and years of consistency across every surface, including clay. Not going to get into the next out guys, Dimitrov, Hurkacz, Khachanov, and Berrettini. A lot of them are players who have been top 10 players this year, but are kind of, you know, the clay detracts from what they do. Khachanov is an interesting case. I might need to consider putting him in there because he's been so good at majors. He's been so consistent in Paris. And then Berrettini is going to be one that I don't think a lot of people will be agreeing with me necessarily, but look, you know my stance with him. The body of work on clay is certainly there, and I just don't think he's that far off of his level, and he already has a clay court title. I know the results in the immediacy don't necessarily support Berrettini's placement in next out, but I think the long-term, like career-long results do indeed support his placement here. And if he's healthy, I think he's going to be in the mix. Now, he pulled out of Madrid, tonsillitis, which is good, right? As long as it's not an injury, that's great news because he will be okay. It's just illness. So he hasn't played Rome in 2 years. Fingers crossed that he's going to get to play Rome this year. I know it means a lot to him. Speaking of which, well, not speaking of Rome, but speaking of the next Masters, I'm going to have a Madrid preview for you coming up later this week. We have that to look forward to and plenty more. Hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.